The theme today is the new paiduma. This word paiduma, an old Greek word, let's say the new teaching. The new teaching with, at its center, a new poetry, a new energy, a new poetic energy. We'll begin with the commentary of a few poems and extracts of poems by Walt Whitman. Then we'll move on to Ezra Pound, who, as we'll see, refers to Whitman. At first refuses Whitman's work and approach, and we'll see why later on. Then, however, recognizes that Whitman, in fact, opened up the field, which now, according to Ezra Pound, simply had to be given more clarity, more coherence. Well, let's look at a few poems and extracts of poems by Walt Whitman. This first extract we'll be concerned with this morning is from a poem called Beginning My Studies. Beginning my studies, the first step pleased me so much. The mere fact consciousness, these forms, the power of motion, the least insect or animal, the senses, eyesight, love. The first step, I say, awed me and pleased me so much, I have hardly gone and hardly wished to go any further, but stop and loiter all the time to sing it in ecstatic songs. So there you have the beginning of a course of study, of a research, and these studies are described as ecstatic. You have a sense of new, opening, nascent knowledge. And if you look at the way, we'll look at this as we go along, if you look at the way the poem hangs together, you've got an idea of how Walt Whitman composes his poems. Beginning my studies, you have this participial phrase very often. Beginning my studies, the first step pleased me so much. And then you have an accumulation. You have a sheer list. You have an accumulation of things, of moments, of perceptions, the mere fact consciousness, these forms, the power of motion, the least insect or animal, the senses, eyesight, love. A kind of rapid, almost breathless accumulation of things in a heterogeneous collection. And then you have the theme taken up again. Beginning my studies, the first step pleased me so much. Then your accumulation, then the theme taken up again. The first step, I say, awed me and pleased me so much. This was the kind of thing which we saw in the street orator, Elias Hicks, in one of the previous lectures, if you remember. The first step, I say, awed me and pleased me so much. And then you have a kind of opening statement. I have hardly gone and hardly wished to go any further, but stop and loiter all the while to sing it in ecstatic songs. The form, if you like, is like a wave gathering energy, gathering momentum, rising up to its height, to its accumulative power, and then moving in a kind of long swoosh into silence. And if you like, introducing you to a whole world. The poem moves beyond itself. It's not asking to be admired for itself. It's a kind of prelude to an experience of the world, to a wider context. That's Whitman's poetry. Prelude to a wider experience. Notice the vocabulary he uses. Loiter, like saunter. A word indicating a kind of easy-ozy, a relaxed way of being and moving. Well, I spoke a little there about the form of Whitman's statements, his way of speaking. This is what comes across in the second extract we'll be concerned with, from a poem called Had I the Choice. Let's look at it. These, O sea, all these I'd gladly barter. Would you the undulation of one wave, its trick to me transfer, or breathe one breath of yours upon my verse and leave its odor there? There you have, if you like, questions of prosody. But Whitman's prosody, he learns from the sea, not from, you know, treatises of versification. These refer to theme, meter, and rhyme. Whitman was considered by certain established critics as writing absolutely formlessly. In fact, he was trying for a new form, for a new shape of things. And he learned from the sea and from rocks, as we'll see. These, O sea, all these I'd gladly barter. Would you the undulation of one wave? There you have this wave movement. Would you the undulation of one wave? Its trick to to me transfer, trick. It uses a very ordinary word to refer to this, the subtle and complex movement of water. It's trick to me transfer. Or breathe one breath of yours upon my verse. His verse is a kind of breathing. It's a way of breathing. A respiration. Breathe one breath of yours upon my verse, and then even more strangely, and leave its odor there. He wants his poetry to have a perfume, an odor, a smell. He wants the poem to smell good. That may seem very, very strange. But the idea again is that the poem should open out into another context and spread like a perfume. Spread out into the world, as it were. These, O sea, all these I gladly barter. Would you the undulation of one wave its trick to me transfer, or breathe the breath of yours upon my verse and leave its odor there? And you get the same kind of idea, the same kind of conception of the shape a poem should have, and that poetry should have, and that poetic speaking should have, in that poem which he wrote in Platte Canyon, Colorado. I'll just read the poem first of all and then comment on it a little. Spirit that formed this scene, these tumbled rock piles grim and red, these reckless, heaven-ambitious peaks, these gorges, turbulent clear streams, this naked freshness, these formless wild arrays for reasons of their own, I know thee, savage spirit, we have communed together. Mine too, such wild arrays for reasons of their own. Was it charged against my chance that they had forgotten art, to fuse within themselves its rules, precise and delicatesse? The lyrist's measured beat, the wrought-out temple's grace, column and polished arch forgot. But thou that revelest here, spirit that formed this scene, they have remembered thee. So there you have a refusal of elaborate verse forms, of delicatesse, of precise rules, and on the contrary, an inclination towards, a predilection for, a love of wild arrays, wild arrangements of things, like a chaos of rock in Platte Canyon, Colorado. If you like, he moves towards a marine prosody on the one hand, and on the other, a geological prosody. It's a geologos. He's trying to get at a kind of earth speech, an earth word, a sea word and an earth word. If you like, a sort of cosmic expression. Not simply art in a small sense, but art which is going to become world. So you have then ecstatic studies, the sense of coming across new knowledge, a new experience of the world. You have a new way of seeing this new experience. And then you have a new interest in sheer physicality. What shocked many readers in the 19th century in Walt Whitman was the sheer presence of physical reality, his own physical reality. His own body was suddenly there, present. The smoke of my own breath, echoes, ripples, buzzed whispers, love root, silk thread, crotch and vine, my respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs. I mean, he was a poet who was speaking about his sweat. I mean, this was not the done thing. You might be able to talk within brackets about your perspiration, but he spoke about his sweat. And this, I say, was shocking in the 19th century, middle of the 19th century. Notice the words he uses, the smoke of my own breath. He doesn't say the vapor. He doesn't use a sort of thin word, a delicate word, the smoke. He uses a thick, pungent word, as he always will, because he's looking for substantial realities. And this sense of personal physicality, of presence of a single body, opens out into a connection with, a rapport with, that's the word he liked, a rapport, he liked the French word, a rapport with a cosmic context. And this is what you have in the following context. Smile, O voluptuous and cool-breathed earth, earth of the slumbering and liquid trees, earth of departed sunset, earth of the mountains misty-topped, earth of the vitreous pour of the full moon, just tinged with blue. Earth of shine and dark, mottling the tide of the river. Earth of the limpid grey of clouds, brighter and clearer for my sake. Far swooping elbowed earth, rich apple blossomed earth. Smile, for your lover comes. And then you have the same techniques, if you like, the repetitions, earth, 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 almost incantatory. Biblical in a sense. This is the kind of style you get in the Bible, in this repetitive style. With, after the accumulation, after the repetitions, smile for your lover comes. A kind of catchphrase, it's a concluding phrase, but which is at the same time an opening phrase. So let's say after physicality, after ecstatic studies, after a geological prosody, after a sense of physicality, after a cosmism, another aspect of this new poetry, is this sense of knowledge coming from a larger context, a wide context of learning and experience, bringing in not only humans, but a large and heterogeneous context. The wild gander leads his flock through the cool night. Ya honk, he says, and sounds it down to me like an invitation. The parrot may suppose it meaningless, but I, listening close, find its purpose and place up there towards the wintry sky. You might call it the mysticism, but let's say, I would prefer to say, a sense of a larger context of meaning. Notice that it refers not to the nightingale or to the dove, you know, sort of respectable poetic birds, as it were. It refers to the wild gander, the wild goose. Notice also that he doesn't sort of interpret the wild goose's speech or cries. He doesn't interpret it into human terms. On the contrary, it gives you the wild, guttural noise, the sound, yah-honk, which has no immediate meaning in human terms, but has a meaning in life and cosmic terms. The wild gander leads his flock through the cool night. There's a spaciousness and a coolness in Whitman. The wild gander leads his flock through the cool night. Yah-honk, he says, and sounds it down to me like an invitation into a more than human world, into an extra human world. The pert may suppose it meaningless, the smart people may suppose this to have no meaning, but I, listening close, if there is meditation, if there is contemplation, if there is attention, but I, listening close, find its purpose and place up there towards the wintry sky. There is a meaning, but it's a larger meaning than the small smart minds can envisage. Another aspect is a new sense of togetherness, of being together, a new sense of human contact and communion. And this comes across in this extract from Song of the Open Road, a title which is significant in itself, Song of the Open Road. Camarado, I give you my hand. I give you my love, more precious than money. I give you myself before preaching a law. Will you give me yourself? Will you come travel with me? Shall we stick by each other as long as we live? We've already spoken about his love for foreign words, again, to widen the context, to have enter into his field of consciousness all kinds of languages, sometimes being represented simply by a few words. But camarado, okay, it has a vague sort of Spanish sound. Camarado, I give you my hand, I give you my love, more precious than money. He's trying to get into a context other than the business and economic context, which for many was going to define the United States. I give you myself before preaching or law, no morality, no pietistic or moralistic religion, no legalism. Will you give me yourself? It's a kind of generosity. Let's say generosity. A generosity. Will you come travel with me? This idea of going somewhere together. Shall we stick by each other? Notice it uses the very ordinary word, the street word. Shall we stick by, to stick by each other? Very ordinary, simple, everyday language. Shall we stick by each other as long as we live? And another aspect of this new poetry, especially on the American scene, with which we're beginning, is this sense of the continent of America. America as vast continental space full of virgin reality. America also as possibility, as a field of potentiality. And this is what comes across in this, the extract to come. And again, you feel the Whitman thing, the Whitman way of speaking, aware of the fresh free giver of the flowing Missouri, aware of mighty Niagara, aware of the buffalo herds grazing the plains, the hirsute and strong-breasted bull, of earth, rocks, fifth-month flowers experience, stars, rain, snow, my maze. Having studied the mockingbird's tones and the flight of the mountain hawk, and heard at dawn the unrivaled one, the hermit thrush from the swamp cedars, solitary, singing in the west, I strike up for a new world. Aware of the fresh, free giver of the flowing Missouri, we don't need to insist on the alliterations there to give the sense of flow, fresh, free, flowing Missouri, and again, this use of specific local names, Missouri, Niagara, and so on. And then the accumulations. Notice the vocabulary, hirsute, which is a rather, let's say, less usual word, because he'll use sometimes sort of semi-pretentious words also. Instead of saying the hairy bull, he says the hirsute bull, to renew things a bit. Notice when he says fifth-month flowers, that's Quaker vocabulary. We talked about it. Fifth-month flowers, January, February, March, April, May. Flowers in May, fifth-month flowers. Having studied the mockingbird's tones and the flight of the mountain hawk, again, typical American birds. These are not European nightingales imported. These are local birds, the hermit thrush, and heard at dawn the unrivaled one, the hermit thrush from the swamp cedars. Again, local scenes. Solitary, singing in the west, I strike up for a new world. That's almost his theme song, if you like. Huh? That's almost a resume of Whitman's whole thing. Solitary, singing in the west, I strike up for a new world. That's his epigraph. So there's this new sense, this opening sense of America. And there's also a sense, which I mentioned to you a few weeks ago, this sense of archaic America, this sense of tapping the root of archaic America. And it's this that comes across in the next extract, which is an evocation of the Indian reality of America, the Aboriginal America, archaic America, the red Aborigines, leaving natural breath, sounds of rain and winds, calls as of birds and animals in the woods, syllabled to us for names. Oconee, Coosa, Ottawa, Monongahela, Sauk, Natchez, Chattahoochee, Caqueta, Orinoco, Wabash, Miami, Saginaw, Chippewa, Oshkosh, Walla Walla. Leaving such to the states, they melt, they depart, charging the water and the land with names. Again, he insists on leaving natural breaths. American Indian culture may longer be there as a sort of institutionalized group, but it is there as names and as breaths. And he'll try to incorporate that as he tries to incorporate the whole living reality of the physical space into this new poetry. The red Aborigines, leaving natural breaths. Again, this participial phrase, leaving natural breaths, the accumulation, sounds of rain and winds, calls as of birds and animals in the woods, syllable to us for names. Then the simple list of Indian tribal names, then finally leaving such to the states. That's their heritage. That's the inheritance they've left. We must be able to use it. Leaving such to the states, they melt, they depart, charging the water and the land with names. And the last poem I'd like to comment on before moving on, the last poem of Whitman's, is this key poem, which is entitled Facing West from California Shores. Facing West from California Shores, inquiring, tireless, seeking what is yet unfound. I, a child, very old, over waves, towards the house of maternity, the land of migrations, look afar. Look off the shores of my western sea, the circle almost circled. For starting westward from Hindustan, from the vales of Kashmir, from Asia, from the north, from the god, the sage, and the hero, from the south, from the flowery peninsulas and their spice islands, long having wandered since, round the earth having wandered, now I face home again, very pleased and joyous. But where is what I started for so long ago, and why is it yet unfound? There's that fundamental question. He's standing there at the end of his poetic activity, more or less. He's also standing at the very limits, at the extreme limit of America, after much exploration and discovery, at the very end of human migrations from the east out and then round the world towards the west. At the end of these migrations, this discovery which we mentioned, he still is asking himself the fundamental question, where was what I started for so long ago, and why is it yet unfound? There is something, some ungraspable whole, which he has not yet managed to express. The migrations of the human mind have not yet come to an end. On the contrary, we're still far from an end. There is still much to be discovered. So Whitman leaves us then with this fundamental question. How is it, and it's everybody's fundamental question, how is it that human desire is never ultimately realized? Is there the possibility of a whole mind? Is there the possibility of a complete presence in the world? How is it that the apparent endpoint of human migration, West Coast America, is not an acme point of human realization? Why is that? I would suggest an answer, but the whole course is an attempt at an answer. But I suggest one answer is that once you've gone round one time, well, you've got to go round again, and again, and maybe again, and again. Go over the same ground. And if we take East as the hypothetical source, let's take it as a hypothesis at least, there's the possibility that in our movement we lost things on the way, and that so as to recuperate what we've lost, it may be worthwhile to go right back to the source and start again. Go over again and again the same ground with the idea that to achieve any kind of realization, human or artistic, and for me they both go together, it takes time and it takes work. And I'd like to quote to you from a Japanese painter who was more or less contemporary with Whitman, at least for a few years, who for me gives the whole project and the whole possibility. This Japanese painter, his name is Hokusai. Hokusai. His dates are 1760-1849. So he was contemporary with Whitman, at least for some time. And here is Hokusai laying down the program of his life. And he has a tremendous sense of the time it takes to develop something really necessary. I'll just read it. At the age of 6, I was seized with a strange mania to draw all kinds of things. At 50, I had produced a great number of works of various kinds, but none completely satisfied me. The real work began for me when I was 70. Now, at the age of 75, I'm beginning to get a real feeling for nature. At 80, I hope to have attained a certain power of intuition, and I hope that it will develop till I'm 90, so that at 100 years of age, I may possibly be able to say that my intuition was that of a true artist. And if I was ever lucky enough to live to be 110, I think that perhaps a deep and living understanding of nature would radiate from every line I drew. I invite all those who live as long as me to see if I keep my word. This was written at the age of 75 by me, once named Hokusai, the old man crazy with painting. Hokusai. Now, it may seem strange for some of you, this is a course in Anglo-American poetry, for somebody to quote from a Japanese painter. But what I'm trying to get across is the idea that culture, real culture, cannot be confined to any national boundaries, Can it even be confined to any one time? I'm trying to give a sense of world currents, of a large field of coordinates. And Whitman learned from the East, as many poets we're going to be concerned with did. Don't forget that Leaves of Grass came out, first edition, 1855. Now this is an important date in world history, because 1855 was roughly the date at which the furthest of the Far East opened up again to European exploration. This was the year, specifically 1853, when Japan opened up again to Europeans, after having been closed, absolutely closed territory, with very, very few exceptions, some Dutch ships, closed territory for 2.5 centuries. Suddenly, Japan, persuaded by Commodore Ferry and a few American battleships, what the Japanese called the Black Ships, Commodore Ferry anchored there in Tokyo Bay and persuaded the Japanese to open up their harbors. And this was an opening up of a whole field of culture, art, painting, and poetry for the West. And it had a tremendous impact on the West. With the opening of Japan in 1853, certain aspects of Japanese culture began to filter into the West. Paintings, prints, the famous Japanese prints, sailors bringing home gifts, gradually began to be known. And one significant year is 1856, when the art collector Félix Braquemont in Paris — Paris was the sort of entry point for this culture, one of the main entry points — discovered this Félix Braquemont, art collector, discovered at a printer's in Paris a book of the drawings of Hokusai, the man I've just mentioned. And the man was absolutely amazed, flabbergasted. This was a new art. This was something he had never seen before. He loved the colors. He loved the sense of light. And he loved the strange way of getting things together, the composition. And the news of this new art spread like wildfire. And the shock, the impact on painters in France, in Paris in particular, was immense. We could make a long list of the painters who were attracted to this art, fascinated by this art. Degas, interested more in gesture. Monet, interested in the play of light. Monet's Nymphéas, which you've probably seen, directly inspired by paintings in a temple in Japan. Van Gogh was absolutely crazy about this art, to such an extent that he said this was the new and real religion. This was real religion. Strong words. Other painters involved: Gauguin, Toulouse-Lautrec, Bonnard. You can make a long, long list. Practically every painter was attracted to, influenced by, this Eastern art coming into Europe, renewing the cultural energies. There was one painter living in Paris at the time, but American in origin, Scoto-American in origin, James McNeill Whistler. And James McNeill Whistler brought this new tendency in art, this new poetics, this new idea of art, to England, to London, via a famous lecture. There are lectures which can really change the face of things, and this was Whistler's 10 o'clock lecture in London, 1885. He put across then this new art, and he was heard by writers and poets in London. He was heard, for example — I won't make a long list, I'll just give you one representative — he was heard by a man called Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde listened to James McNeill Whistler, began to be interested in Eastern art, and began to say things like this: "While the West has filled art with intellectual doubts, personal problems, and spiritual unease, the East has remained close to primary conditions." I'll go over it again because it's a key phrase. This is Oscar Wilde speaking in London. "While the West has filled art with intellectual doubts, personal problems, and spiritual unease, the East has remained close to primary conditions. Whitman and the other poets we'll be concerned with are concerned with primary conditions, less with intellectual doubts, personal problems, and spiritual unease. Now, one of the men who most worked at this new arrival of Eastern poetics and aesthetics into the West, into Europe and America, was a man called Ernest Fenollosa. Ernest Fenollosa. This man's career is very strange. He left the States as a businessman, settled in Japan, and gradually became interested in Japanese art to such an extent that he became an expert on Japanese art, even for the Japanese. And he gathered together notes and fragments and ideas concerning the possible application of these Eastern ideas to Western poetry, to Western art, to Western thought. Because a new thinking begins often with a new art. And he said one of several things which are absolutely seminal, radically important. He says, for example, with Chinese and Japanese philosophy and language in his mind, that the Western intellectual system is a system of brick building. It separates reality into bits, into bricks, and then tries to build a wall with these bricks. It's a logic of classification. You cut off bits, and then you try and sort of glue them together, cement them together. He says this, by the way, is why the idea of evolution was so slow to come into the West, whereas in the East it was there, according to him, almost from the beginning, in Chinese Taoist philosophy, for example. So you have a construction by bits. You first of all cut reality into bits, and then you try and make a synthesis. You try and cement the bricks together. Whereas he's going to try and move towards, via Japanese and philosophy, Japanese and Chinese philosophy, poetry, painting, a more wave-like conception of things, a more undulating conception of things, a more interconnected way of seeing reality. Another aspect in which he insisted was that, in contradistinction to Chinese, let's take Chinese as the representative of this other kind of language, English and French are phonetic languages, which means that we tend to lose the sense of the roots. We tend to lose the realities from which the words came. Unless you know a lot of Latin and Greek, you do not know the roots of the words, because it's lost. And which means that the words tend to lose substance, they tend to lose energy, they tend to lose force. Whereas in ideographic languages like Chinese and Japanese, in the ideogram you do have images, you do see reality. For example, the Chinese for the East, which is an abstract concept, the Chinese ideogram for the East brings in several things: the image of a man, the image of the sun, and the image of a tree. So if you like, it's a man contemplating the sun in a tree. You have a concrete image. And this obviously is important for a more lively expression, a more concrete expression of things. Something which strikes the imagination and the intelligence. And Fenollosa has a lovely phrase to describe this ideographic way. He says that this is a vivid shorthand of the operations of nature. A vivid shorthand, not an abstract discourse, but a vivid shorthand of the operations of nature. And this is almost the definition of poetry. Poetry is a vivid shorthand. And he says that with this kind of thinking, with the adaptation of this kind of speaking into Europe, into the West, we may be able to achieve a conception of things whereby the intellect would be able to, or the mind rather, would be able to flash across regions where the discursive intelligence could only stand and gape. A more lively apprehension of things, a more lively perception. Now, he didn't suggest that we should all learn Chinese and Japanese, but that an understanding of this different type of language, the ideogram as contrasted to the phoneme, might be a way of renewing our expression, our poetics, our apprehension of things in the West. It might, for example, lead to a new apprehension of the roots of European words. For example, the word, the most abstract, almost the most difficult word in the West is the word to be, être. Practically the whole of Western philosophy is a discussion of what to be means. Whereas if you look at the root of the word, it probably goes back to a very, very ancient root, bu, meaning to grow. So that to grow might, to be might mean originally to grow. And that gives you a completely new sense of this word. Possibility, expansion, growth, rather than some kind of static being. So that a new interest in the roots of words, a new interest in concrete realities, could mean a new apprehension of the world. So the invitation, Fenollosa's invitation, is to feel our way back along ancient lines. Prepare the future by a good look at an archaic past. Feeling back along ancient lines. Because it says in the system we have at the moment, in our way of thought, in our methods of thought, and in our ways of speech, the mind, he says, does not achieve the possibility of thinking the half of what it might think. Our mind is numbed by a numb language, by a dead language, by a dead use of language. If you have a dead use of language, the mind is dead. And if the mind is dead, the world is dead. So by renewing language, we may be able to renew perception and apprehension. And he says that in this dead system of language, in this corpse language, nature begins to resemble less and less a paradise and begins to resemble more and more a factory. And the suggestion is that we may be able to move out of the factory and perhaps achieve a new sense of, let's say, paradise. For Fenollosa, in the West, the only language which maintained some kind of sense of this other way of being in the world was poetry. This was the only language which, however obscurely, however inadequately at times, still maintained this sense of not another world, and not a better world in a moral political sense, but a fresher world. Huh? Not another world, not necessarily a better world, but a fresher world. Now, at the death of Fenollosa in 1908, his widow was left with his notes and fragments and his essays and his lectures, and she had the task of finding someone who would be able to make the best use of these notes, fragments, essays, and lectures. She was looking for a bright mind, a sharp mind, who would be able to make the best use of these. So she looked around, and she finally chose Ezra Pound, this man we're going to be speaking of now. Pound himself, as soon as he saw these notes, this packet of notes, was convinced that Fenollosa had really got down to the root of the matter. This wasn't just somebody else giving his, you know, his latest fashion about art, his latest theory. This was somebody who had really got down to the root and was beginning from the root up. This was a radical mind. So Pound took the notes and the fragments and edited a little book. And this is a seminal book, a really important book for any understanding of modern poetics. This book was called The Chinese Written Character as a Medium for Poetry. The Chinese Written Character as a Medium for Poetry. For Pound, this was a radical discussion of what is really valid in thinking and in language. And Pound himself was very much out for what he called the paradiso, the paradiso. Pound himself likes, it's in the Whitman line, he likes foreign words also, and he likes this Italian paradiso. So who was this Ezra Pound? This Ezra Pound, beginning to be active in the beginning of the 20th century, 1908, 1910, 1912. Ezra Pound was born in 1885 in Haley, Idaho. Way out in the sticks, if you like. And I may as well say that he died just a few years ago, 1972, in Venice, Italy. He studied Romance languages at the University of Pennsylvania and at Hamilton College. And then he taught for a while. He taught Romance languages at Wabash College, Indiana. At that time, there was some incident, and for moral reasons, apparently, I don't want to go into the anecdote, but he was expelled from the college, or maybe he chose to leave. I don't want to go into the details. What is certain is that he did leave Wabash College, Indiana, with pleasure. And he also left the U.S., the United States, with pleasure because he was dissatisfied with the state of things. He felt that the kind of work he wanted to do could not be done in the United States at that time. So he left in 1908. And he went, remember he studied Romance languages, he went straight to Spain, France, and Italy. These for him seemed to him the live fields. And then he moved to London. For him at that time, the center where things were concentrating. 1912 to 1919, he's in London. He makes his living doing articles. And he's correspondent of an important American poetry review, Poetry Chicago. Poetry Chicago was one of the big reviews of the time. It's at this time, 1912 to 1919, that he really begins to interest us, and so this will come back. But I'll just fill in very fast a few other details. I mean, I'm not concerned with giving you a complete biography of Ezra Pound, but you may as well have a few other details to take him right to 1972, to his death. Later on, 1919, around about then, he left London for Paris, deciding that Paris was the place to be and to work. Then he decided that it would be much better to go to Italy. So he leaves Paris for Italy, and he settles at Rapallo in Italy. He stays in Italy during the war, 1939-45, and during that time, he does broadcasts on Italian radio, which were considered as treason, high treason, by the American authorities in 1945. He's accused of high treason, accused of very heinous non-American activities. He's accused of fascism, and he did, let's not hide the fact, he did have doings which were connected with fascism in Italy. So he's accused of high treason, and he's shut up in a cage at Pisa. Actually shut up in a cage. However, friends in the US and writers in the US, the only way to save him, if you like, from an electric chair, is to have him diagnosed as psychotic. So he's removed from his cage, from imprisonment, to a psychiatric hospital. He's liberated from there in 1959, and his first move is to go straight back to Italy. So let's not, you know, whitewashed, let's not forget this, let's say, pro-fascist episode, or tendency even, in Ezra Pound's career. Don't let's forget it or whitewash it, but don't let's take that as a pretext to omit to study what is valuable, valid, fascinating, refreshing, invigorating, inspiring in Ezra Pound's work and poetry. Ezra Pound has a tremendous energy both as writer and as teacher. He is very much a teacher in the large sense of the word. The teaching thing is strong in him. Let's look at the titles of some of his books. ABC of Reading. He is concerned with teaching something new. ABC of Reading. How to Read. Guide to Culture. He is concerned with pedagogy. He is concerned with that paiduma. Let's not forget the word. He loathed what he considered to be the habitual system of teaching in certain institutions. He loathed the system whereby teaching is considered as simply providing so much fodder, so much pabulum, so much stuff to be learned up, to be chewed over, and then regurgitated at exam times. He loathed that. He wanted a different conception of teaching, of being together for studies, for growth of being. He considered that teaching and learning should not only be the passing of exams, well, you can do that in the bygone, but should mean the augmentation of a life sensation and the sharpening of one's sense of world. That's what it's all about. And that's what he was after. You might say, and this is my own words, I'd say this, that teaching for him, and for me, by the way, means, okay, information, certainly, as much information as possible. But it also means information. In other words, the way the student receives this information and feels it enriching his own content and context. And information followed by information should lead to transformation. That's what formation is all about, transformation. This word paiduma we'll be concerned with, we'll go into next time, but let's just broach it at least today. This word paiduma, P-A-I-D-E-U-M-A, a teaching, Ezra Pound got from a German thinker called Leo Frobenius. Frobenius was what you call a cultural morphologist. He was interested in cultural morphology. In other words, the study of the shapes of cultures, how cultures are shaped and unshaped, how they change, cultural morphology. And Pound's starting point is that our culture, or our so-called culture, from a morphological point of view, is amorphous. It has no shape and it has no light. So the new poetry, the new teaching, the new paiduma will be an attempt to give to an amorphous culture some shape and some light. And next time we'll go towards that shape and that light.